We're going to get to the calls here for Dr. Daniel Dresner, Theories of International Politics and Zombies. Before we do, I just want to point out, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, there are links in the news section to stories like, could dead stars support life? Or scientists plan to drill to Earth's mantle, and water-powered spaceship could make Mars trip on the cheap. Any one of those scenarios could lead to a zombie apocalypse. We have no way of knowing what that first domino will be for sure. All we can do at this point is just to try to be prepared for when once more the dead walk the earth, because that's the wrong time to ask, and then what? And that's just what we're doing with Dr. Daniel Dresner. We'll take your calls on this coming up. He has added to the growing amount of zombie literature, the academics who study the phenomenon of zombies, the corpus, if you will, with this book, Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and you, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Daniel Dresner taking your calls. We'll start first with Mara in Salt Lake City, Utah, west of the Rockies, on Coast to Coast.
Hello, Ian. I've always loved listening to you. Thank you for being on.
Thank you. It's important that you're on tonight with Dr. Daniel Dresner.
Yes, it really is, because I have a ton of questions, but I'll just ask one. Dr. Dresner.
Yes, Mara.
And I did miss the first part of this, and I apologize. I was working. But when did it first come into your realm of consciousness that there were zombies and the undead, and how did they convince you that they were zombies? How did you first meet them? How did they convince you?
Well, regardless of whether anybody has met one, of course, it's hard to get away from them. Just out of curiosity, have you met any, Mara?
Not that I know of.
Okay. All right. Dr. Dresner, how was it that you decided you were going to dedicate some of your professional work to this?
Well, actually, it started with other serious academic research. I think I mentioned this before. There was a paper by a bunch of biomathematicians at Carleton University speculating about what would happen if, in fact, the zombie virus were to break out, that if, in fact, you had an infection of flesh-eating ghouls. And, you know, it was a very provocative paper. It argued that, you know, civilization as we know it would be wiped out unless the zombies were dealt with very, very quickly. And reading the paper, however, the thing that struck me was that there was no politics in it. It just sort of assumed that the zombies would effortlessly cross borders. It didn't assume that countries would respond in different ways. And this struck me as not necessarily the most productive way of thinking about things. So I started speculating and you know, thinking about it a little more. And as I did research, Mara, I will say what I was surprised by and what I was stunned by was the extent to which people are thinking about zombies now. That, you know, between one half and one third, you know, of all zombie films have been made in the last 10 years. So, you know, particularly since the 9/11 attacks. So, you know, clearly there's a source of concern out there. And I thought that it was important for, you know, only scholarly research was really going to allay these kinds of fears of the living dead. And I wanted to, you know, help to allay those fears.
Well, not to mention offer a blueprint think tanks everywhere who are imagining what their role might be in the coming zombie apocalypse. We'll go first time caller line. Fred is in St. Louis, Missouri, on Coast to Coast.
Ian,
Fred?
How you doing there? I'm glad to talk to you and your guest there. I'm thrilled by this. I personally think that this zombie ideal and a virus is like it's like another step in human evolution. You know, that's the way humanity is going to evolve, and you know, it may be kind of ugly at first, but I think it's really going to do well for all of us. And my question to your guest is that on a personal level, what should we do if we see our relatives and so forth starting to develop as zombies? I mean, are we obligated to try to stop them? Should we direct them towards our neighbors, or should we try to join them somehow?
Well, I think directing them against your neighbors is a little cruel, so I would, you know, strongly caution against that. But you raise an interesting point, and this is probably one of the biggest reasons why zombies could eventually spread, which is if you take a look at the canon, inevitably the sort of interest group that has the strongest, you know, interest in protecting the zombies are the relatives of zombies. And so as a result, you know, the real question you have to ask is, you know, how do you define your family? Is someone, you know, still your brother, your spouse, your child, if in fact they're an undead corpse that wants to eat you? I'm of the conviction that the answer is no. But obviously, you know, your mileage may vary depending upon the family. So, you know, you, for example, were talking about how this would be a natural step in evolution, which means you might be more sympathetic to the spread of undead Americans. I'm not quite sure I buy that argument, but, you know, reasonable people could disagree.
Well, okay, with two things, if I could give some advice to Fred. First of all, remember, don't get bit. Whatever you do. And then secondly, remember the double tap, the double tap.
Cardio is extremely important. You want to be faster than the zombies.
But if we have hospitals that still, I mean, you cannot go into a hospital for services without having to sign a form designating whether you want to be resuscitated or not. How far away are we when we sign a DNR, right? From the permission we would give to a hospital authority to, should we, you know, if we are resurrected, a different kind of DNR, if we are resurrected from death, that we are not allowed to live. Don't let me live. So it's sort of the other side of the DNR is, you know, don't resuscitate me should I die, and don't allow me to come back should I come back as a zombie.
I think, you know, I think clearly the DNR form would obviously have to be extended to include the undead.
The unliving will to go along with the living will.
Yeah, so I think that's actually, it is a good template to provide, you know, for future, sort of a future legal framework and a future healthcare framework in terms of how to deal with this kind of problem.
I've noticed this recently. Somebody told me that in donating blood, they filled out a part of the form that said gender, male or female, and then the next level was gender at birth.
Ah, for transgendered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the remarkable thing is that if you give humans enough time, and this is one of the things that I actually concluded in the book, I wound up being much more optimistic than, let's say, Night of the Living Dead, for example. The fact is the zombie canon generally assumes that you're going to get to the apocalypse relatively quickly, that human beings can't adapt. And I have to say, I think that if you give human beings enough time, human beings are relatively resourceful and adaptable. And so are, you know, I would add, even bureaucracy, you know, government bureaucracies on this.
Yep.
As we know from, you know, classic sources like World War Z. So I actually do think that, you know, civilization as we know it would still manage to survive even if the dead started walking the earth.
Well,
it wouldn't be easy, but
no.
I'm more optimistic than I would think the zombie canon.
Well, but I think, you know, you've got forms now for do not intubate, right, for people that just don't want that. Or how hard is it to imagine if you have a do not resuscitate order, a DNR, that you would have a DNATR, do not allow to resurrect.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. All right, let's go to Douglas, who's in San Francisco on a wild card line on Coast to Coast for Dr. Daniel Dresner of Tufts University. Douglas?
Hey, always good to talk to you, Mr. Punnett, and certainly an honor to speak with Dr. Dresner.
Thanks, Doug.
Yeah, and I have not so much a question, Dr. Dresner, as kind of a challenge, because I feel that you're taking such an important step to present this in an academic form so that people are forced to take it seriously, even if there is a bit of humor involved in the way we discuss it.
Maybe.
But because of your background of education and academia being so well developed, I challenge you in the sense that I feel that the neocon, the liberal, the realist kind of thought processes that you yourself are using to process this phenomena, which I agree with Mr. Punnett, even though he may be saying this in humor, is somewhat inevitable. I feel that it's anachronistic, and that what we are seeing will be a phenomena that is congruent and conducive to a new dark age in which there's no such thing as politics as we understand today, but more conducive to the politics of the old dark ages in which a man's religion is his politics. And it's in light of that, I just wanted to address something that Mr. Punnett brought up about Japan and a kind of misconception of the Asian paradigm. The Japanese already dealt with the undead phenomena, so to speak, during World War II, when there was a massive mobilization of men who were dedicated to the Kamikaze Corps. And when the war ceasefire occurred, those men who had already legally been declared dead were presented back to their families as undead, and their families, of course, rejected them and said, we cannot have the dead in the house. And therefore, these men all became yakuza. They were incorporated into the Japanese underworld because they were no longer part of living society.
Well, you know, I would argue, and I think there's an interesting part of what you're saying that I'm sure is well-researched and true. But I think it's also true that we are overemphasizing this. I think it's a misconception that everybody in Japan was behind the idea of the kamikaze. I think it was considered kind of a fringe belief. It was a desperate belief. Yeah. But I don't know that this was some mainstream acceptance. This is the honorable thing to do.
Actually, that's not the case at all. The kamikaze movement was very much a nationalist movement, and it was part of the national movement.
I don't know. I don't think that that's true. I think there is truth to the fact that there was a historical basis for kamikaze, but it was really on the fringe of the military theory at the time that this was going to work. It obviously didn't work. So, you know, I think those people who said this won't work got to say, I told you so. But even still, so the fact that, you know, maybe it's true that in war, some people are declared dead and then they come back and they were dead. They were not dead all along. I don't know that that's a big predictor of what would happen in the future. So let's just move. I think it's such a rare thing that I don't know that it's an indicator of anything bigger than just maybe a kind of a sniggling point. Let's go east of the Rockies where Jamie is in Atlanta on Coast to Coast. Jamie?
Hey, guys. Great show tonight. You guys were talking about some cultures might be reluctant to shoot their loved ones or their ancestors, mm-hmm. and that would naturally lead to an abundance of some zombies reflecting physical characteristics of certain ethnicities, which could potentially lead to a zombie xenophobia, if you will, among the living. And I was wondering if you thought that humanity could come together against the zombies enough to unite against them, or if they might start turning against the living that also look like the majority of the zombies, and then you would have race wars and human against zombie conflicts. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think that's definitely a possibility. I mean, you're right that, and I think I tried to bring this up in the previous conversation that, you know, if zombies, if the original source of zombies was thought to emerge from a particular ethnic minority or ethnic group, obviously there would be prejudices against the sort of living members of that minority or that race, and that would obviously be a problem. And if it was a country from which this was coming from, you know, you would inevitably see quarantine procedures put in place, that, you know, there would be restrictions on migration of even the living population in those countries. So yeah, that would be a source of concern. I think in some ways the crucial aspect is the extent to which the government would actually be able to have not just promulgate information, but as it turned out, accurate information. You know, the more the government's got right in the initial part of the zombie outbreak, the more trust and goodwill you would likely to see among the rest of global society. The more that those things turned out to be wrong, then, you know, you'd see fear and distrust on the rise.
Sharon is in San Antonio on a wild card line on Coast to Coast for Dr. Daniel Dresner.
Hey, Ian. Yes, Dr. Dresner. I like my zombie scenarios. I know you take in this very seriously, but I do like it with a little bit of a sense of humor. And I like the reference that y'all did to Zombieland, because mm-hmm. that's one of my by far favorite movies, period.
And don't forget Shaun of the Dead, of course.
Shaun of the Dead was it. Was
Shaun,
really...
Shaun of the Dead is highly underrated.
Yeah, not in my house, yeah.
Some basic rules for survival. I know that cardio, double tap, you know, don't be a hero, avoid the public toilet. So do you have any basic rules for survival?
For the international, do we have, and thank you, Sharon, do we have an understanding that what countries should and shouldn't do for survival internationally?
Well, I think one of the important rules I would say, and I would caution against this, I've talked to a lot of international relations scholars who assume that one of the instant things that should be done is that you should use nuclear weapons against zombies. And I am a fervent and I cannot stress enough my opposition to the use of nuclear weapons as a way to counter the zombie threat. And the reason is that, you know, if you consider the use of nuclear weapons, you know, a lot of people would die from the use of a nuclear weapon, obviously from the blast, and you'd probably kill a lot of zombies. But most people die, or a lot of people die from the use of nuclear weapons from radiation rather than the incineration itself. And this is important because if you're trying to deal with the zombies, they're not going to be affected by radiation. In fact, you would probably create the only thing worse than an army of the undead. You would create a mutant radioactive army of
right.
the undead.
Exactly.
And you know, you're talking to someone who grew up on Super Friends cartoons, so I right. know what happens when you get exposed to weird mutant radiation.
Well, except that, you know, maybe, and this is something which I don't know what the math is on this, and this may be outside of your purview, but mm-hmm. when the zombies are putrefying over time, mm-hmm. That maybe the radiation would promote a faster putrefaction, and therefore, you know, slowly they would just, they more rapidly they would break down physically and become less of a threat.
You know, that's a possibility. I mean, that's where you'd have to, you know, this is outside my own area of expertise. I'd
right.
want to take a look and see what, you know, what medical science would come up with. That said, you also don't know how, you know, radiation would affect the zombie virus itself. Whether
oh, that's
it
true.
Lead to different kinds of
right.
mutations.
Different types of mutations, almost
and,
immediate.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, in some ways, it's a risk that
it's
a risk too far as far as I'm concerned.
I'll go with that. Harper is in St. Cloud, Minnesota, on a wild card line. Harper, on what station are you listening to us tonight, Harper?
Tell you the truth, I'm not sure. I heard about this over one of my friends sent an email to another friend through another friend, so I'm just kind of listening in on things.
Glad to have you. So, your question for Dr. Daniel Dresner of Tufts University.
My question is, in the decomposition of the human body, how do you connect that with the zombies? I mean, after the human body dies, it should start to decompose. Would that slow them down? Because with Hollywood and their fast zombies, I mean, they're back in the day, they were slow. Now they're getting faster. How would you look at that?
Well, I think partially depends on what the nature of the virus itself. I mean, you know, the human body can regenerate cells even after death. You know, fingernails continue to grow, hair continues to grow, so there is that aspect of it. The other question is whether or not the zombie virus itself would actually necessarily cause death. If we think about the 28 days later scenario, for example, technically the infected were not dead. And so that might be an instance where, in fact, they could survive for a relatively long period of time. But that said, you're right that, you know, if we know anything about human corpses, there should be, you know, putrefaction over time, and that actually this could vary from place to place.
Depending on diet, depending on,
yeah.
right, some of the living factors as well as the dead ones.
Style and so on and so forth. So,
you know, it'll be interesting is to get whether you could get any colleagues of yours in academia over at the University of Tennessee to take a look at this, you know, at their body farm there in Knoxville, and whether they could be able to start to do some measurements on how long a body might be able, once it was reanimated, to remain ambulatory before the sinew, before the tissue, before the skin totally broke down. I'd like to know that. More on this coming up next, Coast to Coast. Well, just a few more minutes to jump in on this conversation, and the rest will just have to be with you, your nine closest friends, and a cappuccino somewhere. Theories of International Politics and Zombies, Dr. Daniel Dresner, starting the conversation that none of us hope we ever have to live long enough to finish. And you'll get your call in next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Let me bring it right back where we left off, and with no time to lose, Dennis is in Norris Lake, Tennessee, on a wild card line for Dr. Daniel Dresner, Tufts University, Theories of International Politics and Zombies. Dennis?
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I've seen the body farm. It's a scary place. I don't know if I'd panic if they got up, but I'd be on triple secret red alert.
Yeah, really.
So, A place where maybe it might be good to live would be on a cute little Pacific island where they cremated everybody and there weren't many bodies around. And I have a suggestion and a question. Mm-hmm. First of all, if the zombies were given some sort of rights, has the doctor allowed a provision for what if they eventually got enough rights that they could vote? Mm-hmm. And the suggestion on how to deal with them is, couldn't we just cremate everybody and sort of preempt them and maybe cremate everything? And we could kill a couple birds with one stone. We could use it for energy production. Anyway, great show, guys. I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Yeah, I knew I hadn't thought about energy production, but if we were to be if we were to look for a way to recycle this as a resource, you do have that possibility of at least in some sort of controlled ongoing funeral pyre and a way of trying to turn a negative into a positive.
I suppose, but I do think that would require, I mean, it really would, that would require a fundamental change in human culture, the notion that the dead don't need to be treated with respect, that rather you would, you know, treat them as a fuel source.
Well, wait. You treat them with respect the first time.
Yeah.
But once they're the dead, you know, I mean, we see this all the time with people that merely move the headstones at cemeteries or, you know, I mean, I think we do have it. Once there's been a period of time when somebody's been shown some reverence, I don't know, especially if once it's become reanimated, that we have to go through the process of, you know, of going through some sort of burial process. It would be completely inconceivable to manage reburying everybody.
True. Although, I mean, let me put it this way. If you're really genuinely concerned about energy, the other possibility is that you actually allow some zombies to revive and you just put them on a hamster wheel. They become literally a perpetual motion machine.
That's true. I couldn't rule that out.
You know, think about, you know, you could treat them like greyhounds at a racetrack where you'd have like a fake dummy or human or something, you know, just out of reach. So they have to constantly walk to try to get it.
Right. Oh, no, that's good. But I mean, I just think, too, I missed your point about the ceremonial reburial or the way if we were mistreating the dead. You know, isn't it awkward when you go to a wedding of somebody who's already been married for 10 years and then they go through the whole white dress, everybody give presents, church wedding thing, exactly like the other marriage never existed. You know what I mean? It's sort of, there's always something about the second time around that would be different anyway. So
no, that's a fair point. So, I mean, it's possible that, again, human culture can be adaptable. So you maybe would see the kind of change in the process that Dennis suggested. So that's certainly something you'd have to consider.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Jesse is in Arizona on Coast to Coast for Dr. Daniel Dresner. Jesse?
Yes. Thank you very much for taking my call. I've got a couple of questions for the good doctor. Does he think, you know, that zombies could ever become a major threat to humanity? And if they ever do, you know, how do you kill something that is already dead?
Well, we know at least from the literature that the double tap is effective. We know the headshot is effective. But and why do we, what is it that we've learned so far that guarantees the headshot is the one that will end the zombies? Need to get up and keep moving.
You know, again, it always goes back to the brain. And so, you know, if you destroy the brain, the zombie can't do anything. So the key is once you get rid of the brain, you should be fine. And that is the one thing that is common to every, you know, source in the zombie canon. And as to whether or not I think they would actually be become a huge threat, I think that's why I wrote the book, and that's why, you know, you want to do this as much sort of preemptive analysis as possible. You know, good policy comes from good policy planning. So in some ways, thinking about these scenarios now helps us deal with the real world situation if it were to in fact occur.
Why do we think that zombies need to eat brains? I mean, we know that they'll bite other parts of the body. We know that they'll eat other parts. But what is it about the brain of the living that it becomes such a prime directive for the undead?
Well, it depends. The origin of the brains part is actually more recent than you would think from the zombie canon. It's actually from 1985's Return of the Living Dead. And, you know, that was where you saw the first notion of brains. And the argument in that was that the brains were the only thing that took away the pain of being dead. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is, I believe, in Marvel Zombies, you know, the superheroes would eat brains, and that was the only thing that made them sort of intelligent again, like human. And then, you know, then once they became hungry again, they turned back into zombies. So, you know, again, there's a variety of reasons for this. And it raises an important question, which is we haven't necessarily studied too much what the zombie wants. What is it that makes the zombie do what they do? And, you know, if they were to, in fact, walk the earth, you'd want to probably be able to do some research and figure that out. You need to get into the mind and understand the root causes of why zombies are trying to eat people.
Fair point. I think probably some of it just may even go to some primitive culture understanding where those people that eat the heart or the brain of those that they have vanquished as a way of almost honoring their victim.
That's, you know, you could think of it as a real life thing. Or as I said before, it could just be all the result of groupthink.
Right.
You never know. It could be that maybe the first couple zombies thought this would be something cool to do, and everyone else, you know, just sort of went along with the flow like peer pressure.
Right.
So, if you could persuade the zombies that eating people was not cool, then maybe you could have something of along the lines of peaceful coexistence.
Oh, that's very interesting. George, first-time caller line in Las Vegas on Coast to Coast for Dr. Daniel Dresner. George?
Hi, yeah, it's an honor to be here on the show. I'll just make it pretty quick for you guys. I'll just say a name, Max Brooks, comment on how I would think the zombie invasion would look like or resemble.
Well, he did a nice job collecting the oral histories from that first World War, the zombie World War, World War Z. Without him, I think we would be lacking a lot of the information that we have now about the potential, say, for zombies to walk on the bottom of the ocean. They may even be there right now because they don't have the requirements to have air. And we never really thought about that until Max Brooks.
No, Max Brooks was the first one to point out that the stopping power of water would not necessarily stop zombies. And again, I completely agree. World War Z is an outstanding book. And I would say that it's not a coincidence, by the way, that Brooks has been asked since writing that book to, you know, deliver speeches at places like the Naval War College. Because even if zombies themselves don't ever rise up, zombies do represent what I think, you know, former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld referred to as the unknown unknowns in world politics. So even if they don't ever come back, and we can only hope that's the case, you know, thinking about them allows us to think about, you know, to sort of play with ideas and think about threats that are outside the box, as it were.
We'll go to Paul in Amarillo, Texas, wildcard line on Coast to Coast.
Evening. You know, I was wondering is, you know, people are willing to give up a lot of freedoms for security. Mm-hmm. This could be the perfect opportunity for vampires to come out into the public view, sort of come out of the closet, as they'd be the perfect fighters against zombies. So we could end up with a bigger threat with vampires out in the open than we ended up with zombies.
This is an interesting point, and this becomes an interesting question of, you know, when is the enemy of your enemy your friend? So, you know, if in fact zombies were to rise up, would that be the moment for vampires to introduce themselves? And would they actually, you know, be willing to out themselves as walking among the earth? So that is certainly one possibility. Another possibility, by the way, it should be pointed out, is that, you know, one way to combat zombies might be an increasing spread of sort of, you know, robot warfare. You know, the growth of UAVs and drone aircraft and, you know, robot soldiers. That might be one way in which you could also potentially deal with the zombies, because if you have robots fighting zombies, then presumably those soldiers, the robot soldiers, are less likely to be turned into zombies. Although if the zombies could do that and turn the robots into zombie robots, that would be really an apocalyptic scenario.
Well, and I can see where, you know, what we know about vampires being that they're not allowed to enter the home of their potential victim without being invited, that they could, theoretically working with zombies, mm-hmm. break down the doors and the windows and make the initial attack so that the idea of getting permission becomes a moot point.
Well, this leads to a number of interesting questions. One would assume that zombies would not be interested in eating vampire flesh because vampires technically are already dead.
Of course.
And then the second is that, you know, would vampire, as you said, vampires might very well sympathize much more with the zombies than with humans, although you would think that vampires would, you know, based on literary tropes, vampires usually get co-opted into existing power structures. They're much less transgressive in terms of trying to threaten humanity. Indeed, based on recent literary tropes, you know, vampires survive, thrive, and knave and glitter in the world's finest high schools. So, you know, there might actually be natural tensions between vampires and zombies, but of course, vampires would only be an effective opponent of zombies at night. I mean, during the day, presumably they wouldn't be able to do that much. Litter.
Yes, exactly. Let's go to east of the Rockies. Dan is trucking in Texas, listening to Coast to Coast. Dan, you're talking
Hello.
To Dr. Daniel Dresner. Go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Daniel. Hello, Ian. Hey, I was wondering on the way you're describing zombies as, well, some people say that they come from the grave, but wouldn't it be more of a laboratory, something that a government or organization put together where they actually, like you said earlier, reanimated the dead? Or could it possibly be where a government would use the internet or something to get into people who are walking around using iPhones and whatever and literally wipe out their memories through some sort of brain manipulation or brainwashing, and then actually putting in the information that they want for them to start walking around and destroying other countries or things like that?
That's certainly a possibility. I think, in fact, Stephen King's Cell was based on a premise like that. You're right. I generally think that if zombies are going to be created, it's likely going to occur at some sort of, you know, secret lab where there's a mistake, and or they were intentionally created but things got out of control, or you could see it through an electromagnetic pulse or electric pulse, you know, through cellular networks and so forth. That would be another possibility. So I agree with you, the likelihood of actually the dead rising from the grave literally is unlikely. I think it's more likely they're going to rise from a lab somewhere.
Well, and wouldn't it be completely consistent with our government that we would be trying to create once more a super soldier? I mean, think of the epidemics with which we still live to this day because of our belief that we could create the soldier that could not be beat, like through LSD or through other drugs, which would make a soldier impervious to pain and able to march for 72 hours without rest.
This is, in fact, one of the premises for a more recent film, Zombie Strippers. Was the argument was that was why the zombie virus was created, in fact, because the United States had run out of live soldiers, and so the only way to do it was to reanimate the dead ones.
That will be completely my justification when I tell my wife that's why I rented that.
Well, you know, I had to do it for research, so.
I understand. Richard is in Jackson, Mississippi on a wild card line on Coast to Coast. Richard?
Hello, and thanks for having me on the show. And I wanted to talk about the idea of possibility of a country like India where they mainly cremate their dead faring much better in a situation with zombies than someplace else.
Well,
because
yes and no.
Bodies there for it.
We remember, too, the other option is to float them down the Ganges. So you would have sort of almost a zombie navy that would be ready to go.
Yeah, India is one of those interesting questions where it's not clear which way it would break. Because on the one hand, it is a democracy, which is one of the things that you know, it's a good sign for dealing with these kind of apocalypses. On the other hand, it's so incredibly densely populated that if, in fact, a virus were to really break out there, you know, the likelihood of it spreading would be remarkably high. And so that would be a genuine source of concern.
But I do think it does get to a certain point. The countries that have practiced a level of cremation would be the ones least susceptible, at least to an internal threat. They may be most susceptible to an external threat.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you look at certain Orthodox religious practices that don't allow cremation. You look at Greece. You look at until recently, very recently, Catholic countries traditionally didn't practice cremation. Only American Catholics have adopted that really in the last 10 years or so as anything kind of common. They would be the ones that you would think would be the ones most likely to be susceptible, again, depending on what the origin of Zombie Zero is. All right, let's go to Travis in Rockford, Illinois on a wild card line as we're quickly running out of time for Dr. Daniel Dresner. Travis?
Hi, I'll just make this real quick and make my comment off, or hear the comment off the air. In the original Night of Living Dead, you know, they made it clear that just the bodies of the recently deceased were coming back, and then in movies like Return of Living Dead and Zombie 2, you know, they came out of the ground. I was just kind of wondering how many of your scenarios would change based off of just the recently dead versus all the dead buried.
Yeah.
I think in some ways, again, it really obviously the more undead that are created, presumably the more immediate the problem becomes, and it's become more likely that sort of government services would be overwhelmed. I think the other question becomes, how widespread is the phenomena? You know, in the original Night of the Living Dead, if memory serves, it was the eastern part of the United States that was affected. If it was a global phenomenon, that would be something different. So I think, generally speaking, the more zombies are created in the initial act of creation, for lack of a better way of putting it, the bigger the problem for human civilization. If it was only sort of the recently dead and only in a localized area, that would allow, you know, governments or give governments somewhat greater time to respond.
We may have time for Dave in Oregon, and that may just put an end to it here on Coast to Coast. Dave, you're talking with Dr. Daniel Dresner.
How you doing, Ian? How you doing, Dr. Dresner?
I'm doing good.
Quick question for you. Wanted to find out if the zombies would be almost like a brain dead feral state, just a kill for food, or if they might have an almost human type intelligence.
Well, we do have some conflicting testimony on that.
No, and it's true. I mean, if you take a look at the canon, there are some zombies that, you know, demonstrate intelligence, and there are some zombies that don't. I mean, George Romero's zombies, for example, actually evolve over time. You know, in the original Night of the Living Dead, they seem pretty stupid, not terribly sophisticated. By the time you get to Land of the Dead, though, they appear to have sort of a hierarchical command structure and are able to, overwhelm human defenses with some strategic design. So, and then there are other zombies, like in Return of the Living Dead, where they've got serious amounts of intelligence. When I wrote the book, I didn't want to make that assumption precisely because there is so much dispute within the zombie studies community. So you always want to start with weaker assumptions rather than stronger assumptions when you're developing, when you're trying to describe something. So I think, you know, the minimal assumptions I did about zombies allowed me to consider all the different kinds of scenarios.
Well, let's just hope we never know. You know,
I agree. Yes.
And that brings us then to some parting thoughts. If you had one sort of operating warning to give us, what would it be so that we might be prepared for our best case scenario politically, internally, and internationally?
I think the primary warning I would give is that in all likelihood, governments would screw up their initial response. Bureaucracies almost by definition develop standard operating procedures to try to figure out how to make their way in the world, and it would be safe to say zombies are not a standard outcome. But that said, and this is important, is that even though I think governments would likely screw up initially, they would adapt over time. And so as a result, they would learn from their mistakes. Bureaucracies would learn from their mistakes. Governments would learn from their mistakes. So I think the key piece of advice I would give is that even if governments make mistakes the first time, that doesn't mean you therefore cease to trust them.
Kind of what Aristotle said when he said political societies exist for the sake of noble actions and not of mere companionship. So we have to keep working toward that nobility, hopefully, to build a better future. Or, another bit of advice, perhaps, remember, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of flesh.
Very true.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you for having me on. This is a fun conversation.
Well, it was a life-saving conversation. We can only hope. Theories of International Politics and Zombies, you can link up to Dr. Daniel Dresner right there online. Deus te amat, and I do too.